I was raised without much faith or spirituality. I went to this thing, it's Catholic. It's weird. You get a statue of Father Joseph and you put something under it that you want. And I wanted a co-founder for Dream Fuel, somebody who was that caliber. You know, I'm thinking kind of superstitious, obviously, but just whatever. The hiring manager knows me really well and was like, this person's a freaking rock star. She's got a neuroscience degree from Notre Dame. We want to hire her, but she's the right fit for you. So I talked to her. I see there's like a cross over her right shoulder. I was like, oh, you know, you're Christian. That's cool. She's like, yeah. Understanding she was a former pro athlete, a neuroscientist, loves this stuff, super high integrity, checked like every box I could ever want to check for a co-founder. And then that little nod to the superstition of what I was doing, it was kind of a miraculous interview experience.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. The Higher Learning Podcast, we are obsessed with how the best of the best identify top talent, and we tell the stories of the world's most brilliant executive and founders. And today, we have a very special episode. We're joined by Kevin Bailey. Kevin is the co-founder and CEO at Dream Fuel. Kevin, how are you doing today?
Doing great, man. Great to be on.
I'm really grateful for you coming on. I know you're based out of Indianapolis. I know you're very busy, and I'm just glad we're getting a chance to have a conversation. Here's what I'm excited about. I want to find out a little bit about your company, Dream Fuel, because as I did a little bit of research and started digging in on the mental health or mental performance side, particularly working with executives, that's something that I spend a lot of time thinking about and something that over the last 5 to 10 years, I know has become a more prominent space. So let's dive right into it. You're the CEO and co-founder of Dream Fuel. Tell us what the company does, and I want to get into the specific gap it's addressing in the actual market.
Yeah, no problem. We're a mental performance coaching company working mostly with founders and CEOs, and then sometimes we'll drop into their teams as well. So my co-founder is a former pro athlete, neuroscientist, graduate of Notre Dame, and I am just a serial entrepreneur, three startups, first one was super high growth, and realized through a few of these ventures that just it was brutal for me mentally, even when you're doing well. And then kind of my second venture was Powder Keg, which is a tech community for the Midwest. And as I started to really survey and talk to more founders, I saw it wasn't just me, it's kind of everyone. We're getting rocked pretty hard by the experience. And it was lucky that I met a neuroscientist and a few other coaches who really opened up my eyes to what was happening in professional sports before it was kind of more popular as it is now. And I was like, these tools and these types of people need to be working with founders and CEOs because we are under similar level of pressure.
Yeah, I love that. And so do you find that it's both mental health and mental performance, or is it more leaning on the mental performance side, or does it just matter case by case?
Yeah, the way I like to describe it is to think of mental health as a spectrum. So you have kind of the downside of mental health where you call it a clinical condition. Maybe it's clinical depression or anxiety or something like that. And then you have this like middle ground where you're like mentally healthy, you know, so you'd be like not overweight, you know, you'd maybe be in, you'd be not in bad shape. You'd be like, you know, okay. And then you have this whole spectrum above that, which I'd call like being a mentally fit. And that's the performance zone. So a mental performance coach, the question is, you know, how much can we increase your performance by teaching you tools that help you perform under pressure? And I find that a lot of founders and CEOs and a lot of athletes don't tend to have mental health clinical conditions, but they do chronically put themselves in extremely intense situations, similar to like other people that do this, be like, you know, people in the military and stuff like that. Granted, your life's not on the line typically as a founder. Sure. But the stress they put themselves under is incredible, and that can lead to poor mental health and symptoms like that. But it's not.
Yeah, listen. So, like, yeah, I love that. I recently it's become a more obvious topic, particularly in professional athletes. You know, NBA players like DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love have talked openly about some of their different challenges. But then you also look at it from a performance perspective, right? There is a ton of pressure. I'm interested, like, you're obviously familiar with, like, say, a Chuck Knoblauch, a guy who, like, all of a sudden, professional second baseman and couldn't make a throw. Rick Ankiel, like, had to move from being a pitcher to the outfield because of that. Any comparison you would have there for maybe a founder? Does that happen with founders and entrepreneurs as well, where they just, the things that they always used to do, they don't do anymore?
Yeah, you see that kind of stuff happen a lot on putting greens, like the yips. I kind of like to say, you know, that stuff happens in the boardroom and nobody sees it, but your principal investors and the people who matter most in the company. It's obviously with an athlete, you got a million people watching you and they're writing news stories about you the next day. When it happens to a CEO or a founder too many times, you find that they tend to exit the company often by force. So it's really important. CB Insights, I think their stat is approximately 43% of failed startups mention mental performance and mental health issues as contributing to the failure of the startup. So it's a big deal. It's just, It doesn't get as much attention as it should because, again, it's happening privately in boardrooms. Not happening.
And many times it's hard to recognize that it's even happening unless you're one of these principals or one of these investors, like you mentioned. Yeah. I'm interested. You've been a serial entrepreneur and you've been involved with lots of different companies. Did you know that you always wanted to be an entrepreneur? Was that something that you kind of leaned to as a child as you were growing up, or was it something you more fell into?
Yeah. I mean, I come from a long line of entrepreneurs. A lot of people I think that are entrepreneurs have that, starting back from my family during the Great Depression through my dad who owned automotive facilities. And then, on to me. So I would say when I was a kid, I admired my dad for what he did.
I
was ready for it. Yeah.
All right. So let's dig in there. You've been in three startups that are in wildly different industries. You mentioned them earlier. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in like the lesson you took away from each one. And then maybe not only that, but the lesson and how you applied it into the next company, into the next role. I know I do that. I've only been in one company, but I have multiple companies within here. But I try to learn and I make mistakes like anybody else and I try to apply it. But I'm really interested in this idea of like starting anew and saying, I'm not going to go down that road again. So can you give us some examples of that maybe throughout your journey here?
Yeah. I mean, the first company was a MarTech company, pretty high growth. We were the fastest growing company in our state in 2011. And I went into that company wanting to buy my favorite car and had, young man aspirations with it. And, it ended up being the most soul transforming experience that I'd ever experienced. And changed me in so many ways. And I remember there were times as a CEO, I consider myself a pretty high performer. And I remember when there were just times where I would sit in front of my laptop and I would like just be frozen when the pressure got high enough. And I would stare at my laptop for hours and not do crap. And that would happen frequently. And that was when I started to realize like what's going on with my psychology where I just can't make decisions at the moment for some reason. I'll sit there. I don't know if you've ever done this before, but just fiddle with an email. I mean, granted it's an important email, but you'll take 30 minutes to like get all the wording right and stuff. And I learned, from a neuroscientist that I met at that time that I was in the freeze response. And the freeze response is, as I'm finishing my master's in applied neuroscience right now, is a combination of acetylcholine and cortisol. And if you walk up to someone and you inject them with acetylcholine and cortisol, the heart's going to slow down and they're going to be frozen. Be like if a polar bear walked into your room right now, you'd go into the fetal position without thinking about it. Most people would. But I had a lot of that running in my bloodstream and it was causing me to be really slow. CEOs, I think the stat's kind of crazy. It's from CEO Genome Project. I think it's 12X. Decisive CEOs are 12 times more likely to be successful. 12X. So a CEO who's indecisive is a killer. And I noticed that I was having that problem. And then I started to notice the other responses, flight response. I noticed when I was in a fight response, when I was in a focused or flow state. And I was like, how the hell do I choose what state I'm in instead of just reacting and just automatically going in these states? And again, that's when this neuroscientist that I met kind of helped coach me on how to do that and take control of the way I showed up to be able to get into flow state proactively and stay there. And that was kind of the aha for me. And I started to teach some of my friends who are in the tech community in Indianapolis this stuff, and it blew their minds too. And those were our first clients at Dream Fuel. But I just realized you don't have to be a victim of your state. You can choose it. Obviously, you got to learn those tools.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that I've read a lot about flow state. I can tell when I'm in the flow. I love that it's been an analogy that we hear about it in sports, right? Where, somebody's, they're on fire or they're in the zone or they're clutch or whatever it may be. But I really believe that in the professional world, a lot of times I'm getting into flow, or I'm in, you know, I'm giving a presentation perfectly, or I'm really, you know, decisive and making great decisions, or I'm helping kind of drive things, right? Can you describe flow state to people and like what it's like to be in it? And if you have any tips on how to get to it, like that'd be great too.
Yeah. I mean, it's a wonderful state. It's a combination of some of those potent neurotransmitters and peptides and hormones that our body can create. One of the biggest hallmarks of it is you lose track of time. So a lot of people call flow state just being in the zone. But I mean, it's when you like look at the clock once and you look at it again and it's like an hour went by and you didn't even realize, you know, 5 minutes went by. I think that's one of the biggest ones. You get this kind of like warping of time. But you're also incredibly fast. So you sort of lose that inner critic part of your mind that's always kind of talking trash, and you just execute. And you get done. I think it's 5 times more productive is the research by MIT and McKinsey. It's probably the most quoted research on flow state. So you're fast.
What do you have to do from an environment perspective? Is like, do you have to be non-disrupted? Do you have to be in an area very comfortable? Does it have to be like the right ambient lighting or the temperature? Like, help me understand what the environmental circumstances look like in flow state.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things you can do, and in fact, being able to task switch and stay in flow state is a really important thing to tune and work on, because as CEOs, we do have to task switch a lot. If you've been disciplined enough about how you scheduled your day and stuff like that, you can create these periods of deep flow. I think that's kind of what you're asking about. With deep flow, obviously, like you have to have a large chunk of time that's uninterrupted. So no meetings, you know, take your cell phone, put it in a box in the corner of the room. That's kind of what I do. I have a box. I put my cell phone, I don't touch it, you know, keep it away from me, keep it muted. You don't want any distractions like that. If you have sensory issues, like light bothers you or something like that, you want to get all that stuff tuned right. There's been research about having live plants around you, maybe a good view, like if you got a mountain view in front of you, a window, stuff like that. Nice view of the city can help. So that stuff's good. But the main thing, the killer of flow state is your phone and all the notifications on your computer. Turn all that stuff off. If you really want to go heavy in the flow, I like to do a breathing exercise beforehand. So there's various breathing exercises. You know, I think for those who probably know him, Wim Hof has a good breathing technique. There's other ones that are better, but it'll take me a while to explain. And then to take it another level, and this has been well studied in neuroscience now, thank God, binaural beats are solid.
What is that?
So binaural beats are basically, you can look at them on YouTube, but they are a sound that basically puts one frequency in one ear and one frequency in the other, and it can entrain you to certain brain waves. So the brain waves, gamma, alpha, theta, delta, gamma, beta, alpha, theta, delta. That's from really heightened productivity to sleep. And you can actually use binaural beats to entrain theta brain waves, which are really calm. But gamma is like the highest productivity one. So you can like get gamma brain waves coming in, and that'll just get you super focused. Beta is kind of like, think of it as like being on the top of the ocean. You're being knocked around, loss of focus. Gamma is like you're just locked in. Alpha is like meditative state. Theta is like really meditative, and then delta is sleep. So
I love that. I'm definitely going to check that out. So you go onto that on YouTube and you just have your AirPods in, and it's going to be tuned to each ear.
Yeah.
And it'll kind of get you whatever.
Yeah. The brain just entrains to the middle frequency. So it'll put one frequency in one ear, one frequency in the other. You have to use headphones, and the brain will just automatically entrain to the middle. And that middle is going to be the brain wave that you'll sink into. So try it. I mean, it's like I said, it's been studied. It used to be kind of like debated, but now it's been well shown, well researched by neuroscience that it works. Huberman did a big episode on it. He's a decent neuroscientist.
Yeah, it's super badass. And I do listen to Huberman. I didn't hear that one, but that is really, really cool. One of the things that this is going to sound like, you know, a very naive comment, but one of the things that I learned about 5-6 years ago is how underrated breathing is, right? To top performance and mental clarity and where we need to be. And it just sounds like, so yeah, no shit. Right. But ultimately I remember reading, Tools of Titans by Tim Ferriss.
Yeah.
And Tim, as you may know, does all these pods. He's talking to people who are in the top 2-3% of whatever their vocation is. And I remember in the book, one of the things he says is, because he asks all the questions, and I gotta be honest, a lot of the format of this show is kind of pulled from the way Tim Ferriss does it, just from a hiring perspective. And he said that the one highest indicator of all of the people that were like in this genius level or these people that were so highly accomplished was that they all meditated, right? And then I started reading about transcendental meditation. And then I read about Wim Hof. And I remember having a, you know, one of, out of COVID, I came for a conference that I was going to speak at. It was one of the first I had done in public. And I remember being, you know, it would be my Chuck Knoblauch situation. I remember being unreasonably nervous for something that I had done many, many times and to great success. And I remember going through some Wim Hof exercises to get my mind right. And it actually ended up turning out okay, mm-hmm. And pretty good. But I think a lot of that had to do because I had to get my breathing right. I had to get my state right. And I try to meditate at least 3 to 4 times a week. I'd like to do it more. But I just find that when I do that, I find myself not so caught up in the moment, not so caught up in the emotion, looking at myself almost as a third party with a joystick and making decisions. And so I really think that's an important perspective because I think a lot of the worst decisions we can make is when we're too caught up and we're in the moment, yep. And we're leaning on these visceral emotions.
Incredibly reactive.
Where I think the breathing exercise can really help you with that. Like even like taking some big oxygen hits up into your brain, you know, breathe deep breath wise before you go out into a speaking engagement has made a tremendous impact for me. So it sounds like you feel the same way, and that breathing exercise and deep breathing, and I'm sure meditation is that part of your routine as well?
Oh yeah. I've been meditating for maybe 15 years. I started with TM. And yeah, I think the crazy thing about breathing is you can use, I talked about those 4 states of consciousness, which we're always in one of them, you know, fight, flight, freeze, and focus. Sometimes called fawn or rest and digest, the focus one. But you can use breathing exercise to put yourself deep in any one of those states, meaning you can put yourself in bad states, good states. Most maladaptive states like flight or freeze are initiated by a breath hold. So, you know, when something happens that pisses you off, like you, first thing you stop breathing, you tense your muscles, and that puts you right into a flight response, literally like turns the spigot of cortisol on. So like, you know, you just start filling yourself up with it because you're not breathing. So if you can remember just when you hit adversity, just to actually take a breath and keep breathing, like you'll get a much less of a flight response, much less of a freeze response or fight response. But yeah, I mean, people would be, I don't know if you've ever done holotropic breath work or somatic breath work. It's kind of like, think about Wim Hof breathing cubed or something. The states you can induce with somatic breath work are blow people's minds. I mean, you can go so deep into a flow state, like you'll be, you could take one of the hardest situations where you're just like so frustrated. You can do somatic breath work and you'll be like, just like it's a day at the beach or something. And it's fast, 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, you can shift your state entirely.
I'm writing these things down because I'm going to check them out maybe after this podcast because this is great stuff.
We do a session on Thursdays for CEOs. I'm happy to invite you to Alex, who's an awesome mental performance coach who's been doing this for 18 years with pro athletes and stuff like that. He leads it. I'm happy to invite you.
I definitely want an invite. This is amazing. Our listeners are so jealous right now. I appreciate this, man. I'm learning a lot right now. I'm somebody that is a founder. I am a CEO and entrepreneur. Mental aspect of business and performance is truly important to me, but I want to hire people that have, you know, the ability to have high mental performance. They're in a heavy state of focus. They're able to drive and get things done. I look at that as one of the key behavioral traits that I want out of somebody who has maturity in this space. How would you advise a founder like myself or anybody else to assess, you know, people in front of you to get an understanding of how they're going to perform when like the rubber hits the road or when they hit adversity? Because you only have so much time to find things out in an interview. How can you kind of create situations or questions to help you understand that?
Yeah, no. So the things you're looking at, if you want to assess the mindset of a candidate, you want to look at discipline, you want to look at resilience, you want to look at focus, confidence, vitality, and motivation. We call those the 6 pillars of mental fitness. And I thought about some questions you can ask to kind of get at the root of these. And these are questions I ask in interviews. If you want to kind of knock all 6 of those down, the first thing I do is ask if you were a collegiate athlete. So, if you want a person with a great mindset, typically sort of D1 collegiate athlete or something like that, they're going to have most of that stuff nailed because you kind of have to do it to perform in sports. So that's kind of like the hack. But a lot of people aren't collegiate athletes, obviously. Kind of going through the pillars, you know, discipline, I always ask them, you know, describe your morning routine. If they don't have a morning routine, probably going to be a little less disciplined. If they have one, have them describe it, see the detail of it. Then you're going to find somebody who's more disciplined with other aspects of their life. If they got to the point where they have a morning routine, they're probably good discipline in other things, especially if they can hold it. Resilience. Tell me about the biggest setback you've ever went through.
What are you looking for out of that? If like, because most people will be able to give an answer there, right? What are you looking for?
I look for the language of how they describe it. So I'm trying to assess, you know, do they have a victim mentality or an owner mentality? Do they talk about how it happened to them? Do they talk about how it you know, destroyed them? Or do they talk about what they learned from it and how they grew from it? That can help you understand if they have a growth mindset or if they look at themselves as a victim. And often I'll ask, you know, what did you do to recover from that? And how long did it take? You know, did it take them 2 years to recover from this setback, or were they able to pretty quickly adapt and bounce back? You know, if it's more specific, like a sales situation, like tell me about a call that devastated you, you know, how did your calls go for the rest of the day?
Okay. Somebody has, keep going, taking notes here. I like this. I'm a nerd about this stuff. So I love
somebody
it.
Somebody has really good resilience will be able to bounce back from a bad call and have great calls toward the end of the day. Focus. The hack of that is describe your relationship with social media. You know, describe how you handle social media, describe what you do with it. You know, if they don't have a great answer for that, like they haven't thought about it, it's the biggest killer, biggest distractor. There's the biggest killer of focus. So that's kind of how I start the conversation.
Do you love it when somebody's like, I don't use social media at all, I'm completely off the grid when it comes to that? Does that sound like somebody too that's disciplined?
Yeah, it sounds like somebody who prioritizes focus. Okay. You know? As far as
vitality?
Yeah, vitality. This is a kind of a hack on that one, which is like, how do you handle afternoon slumps? So what you want to hear is, don't really experience that too often. You know, if somebody says, well, I do slow down a lot in the afternoon around 2 PM, something like that, which can happen. I mean, it's a transition between dopamine and serotonin. Then you want to like, do they have a good strategy for it? How do they describe it? But you know, if you want somebody with high energy, like they don't really have afternoon slumps. It's a good way.
It's like the fourth cup of coffee kicks in for me at 3 o'clock. There you go. I don't know if that's a red flag, but yeah,
if they talk about their coffee routine, at least they're like handling it. But if you find somebody who doesn't need coffee, who doesn't have afternoon slumps, then that's a very high energy person.
Love it. Motivation.
Motivation is tricky. You know, it's a hard one to, I don't got a great hack question for that. I think you can assess motivation by how they go through the interview process. You know, are they like on top of it? Are they the one, you know, bugging you, you know, are they willing to like, look silly by just annoying you? Are they on it? You know, were they there ahead? Do they come to the meeting early? Do they send the follow-ups? Because if you ask somebody about, you know, talk about motivation or something like that, they're going to give you some BS answer probably. But I think that's always behavioral.
You can tell there are actions speak out for that. And then confidence, is that another one that you have a tell, or do you have a hack there?
Yeah, I like to ask about, describe a time you had imposter syndrome and how you overcame it. Everybody's had imposter syndrome at some point, and they probably have imposter syndrome right now on the call, you know, that's a new role, whatever. So, you know, try and get an honest story about it.
Yeah, let me ask you a question about imposter syndrome, because I've wondered about this. I just think the idea of it is kind of a fallacy, because anytime you're doing something new, right? Like you're always going through a learning curve. You're always, you know, there's got to be some level of like, okay, I haven't done this before. And that's what confidence is. Confidence is I've done this before. I've had success. I know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Anytime you move up into a new role or go to a new company or take on something new, I mean, I'm very, very confident, but there's always times where like, okay, I have to feel my way through 100%. This. I'm going to learn it, but I look at it as an opportunity. I don't look at it as something that brings me down. So that's kind of like my relationship with imposter syndrome. What if I answered that in the interview? What would you say? What's your reason?
That's a great answer. I think it's a fantastic answer. You admitted that you kind of experienced it a little bit, but you had a different perspective on it. Typically when it comes to imposter syndrome, which a lot of CEOs and founders have, because they're always kind of pushing themselves to the next level, a good visualization practice is a great way to get over it. If you see people that are jealous of those around them who are more successful, those peers, that's a sign of a fixed mindset. So, you know, if they're like, tell me about the people who are, tell me the people who are five steps ahead of you and describe, you know, how you view them. If they're like, I'm going to take them down. Or if they're like, they're inspiring, like, you know, I take notes, I'm going to beat them at their own game or whatever, you know, because you can tell some people that they can't stand the people who are ahead of them. That's a fixed mindset. It's not good. But yeah, I mean, I think you got a great perspective on it.
Kevin, I got to tell you, we do a hiring podcast. We're close to 100 episodes now. I'm not sure I've ever gotten as good intel on questions and hiring. That was fantastic. I really appreciate that. Awesome. I'm going to ask you one last question, and then we're going to move to the formal hiring questions. The cocktail shrimp at St. Elmo's, overrated, underrated, properly rated?
I love them, man. I like hot stuff, though. I'd say, you know.
Is it super spicy? Is that why people love it so much?
Yeah, it's really real spicy. Real. It's a ton of horseradish.
Is it just the horseradish, or do they add something else to it that makes it spicy?
I'm not sure. It's a ton of horseradish. If you're like drinking with your friends and, you know, eating hot or spicy shrimp, it's fun. You know, talk about being focused, getting in the zone. Like, it's hot enough that it just pulls you in the moment. It's kind of like that Hot Ones podcast, you know?
Yep. Watch a lot of that too. Another guy that I emulate a lot in terms of his questions and what he's doing.
Yeah.
I'm not a hater on him. He's way more successful in the podcast space than me, but I'm trying to learn. And
there you go, man. Same. I'm
going to get hired at Dream Fuel by the end of this podcast.
I love it, man. Yeah. Let's have an interview.
Okay. Well, if I come to Indianapolis, which I haven't found myself there often before, just the airport, we're going to go to St. Elmo's. We're going to get a couple of drinks.
Let's do it.
We're going to cry over cocktail sauce. Sound good?
And we'll record that, and that'll be the next podcast.
That'll be the next interview. I love it.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
All right, so let's do it. Let's talk about the hiring. You've already given us so much great intel, so many different things that I'm already taking away. I'm interested on a more day-to-day basis, building your own team, building your own organization. What's a core hiring philosophy for you? What is something that you an axiom or a principle that you stick to when it comes to bringing people into your organization?
I think one of the biggest ones for me that I fell victim to in my first startup is I like to hire people who are like me. And I know it sounds amateur at this point, but I created a lot of redundancy in my organization by hiring people that were like me. Now I look for who is so different from me, it makes me uncomfortable. You know, like who sees the world totally different than me? And I try and hire like that now.
Do you have a question that you ask to help determine that? Like, is there something where like, you know, where you stand on something and you're actually trying to find somebody who has like that diametric opposite point of view or perspective or viewpoint, anything that you would point to there? Or do you have a favorite question in general?
I'm a futurist. So I love asking questions about how people think the future is going to be and seeing how much they're willing to divulge. And it does give me a little bit about their mindset. Do they see like, you know, doom and gloom, or do they see opportunity, stuff like that? But I would say somebody who, cause I'm like an eternal optimist. I would say somebody who sees doom and gloom would be interesting to me. Like, why? You know?
Maybe depends on the position too. If you're hiring a
CFO,
risk analyst,
you know?
Or CFO, right? You might say, okay with the pessimist.
Yeah, we coach CFOs and they want to have develop a more abundant mindset and more optimistic mindset. I'm always kind of like challenging them on that. I'm like, do you really want to? You know that your risk aversion is one of the main reasons you have this job.
I think one of my key traits in my role is that I know how to recruit and draw people to my vision, but also I'd like to think that I know how to build high performing teams. And I believe having diverse mindsets, having people that have different characteristics than myself, as long as we have aligned values and some of the core principles, is really the key way to do that. And I am tailor made to what you just talked about. And I think most CEO and founders are. I believe in abundance. I believe in that we're living in the best time in the history of the world, exactly. And it's only going to continue to get better. You know, death rates are down, child mortality rates are down, medicine and vaccinations are up, where the wealth of people is higher than it's ever been. And yet we keep focusing on the news and all these different channels out there, focus on the things that are not well, because if it bleeds, it leads. And it's not that I'm, you know, myopic, or I don't think that these problems exist or that there's real problems that we have to fix. But I also believe that, you know, humans and society in general has overcome a lot. And you know what? Like, the thing that always I find hilarious is like, you keep hearing, this is the most divisive it's ever been, or this
is the they want you to think that, been. Right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know what, man, were you around during the Black Plague or like medieval times or like, you know, really? Like, so I just, that's my mindset about things. And I don't know if that just makes me an eternal optimist or someone that says, there's a lot out there that I want to go out there and get. And I believe in that. But to that point, if I just hired a bunch of people with only that mindset, then, you know, maybe we'd run out of money or maybe we'd run into a bunch of risk and issues. So having those kind of complementary behaviors and skill sets, I do think is
important. I got a question for you, with you being the expert in this.
Please.
I find that the most challenging things I've dealt with as a founder from a hiring standpoint is hiring people who are high performing, low integrity. And I've had a tough time questioning and trying to discern if somebody is high integrity. Because obviously a high integrity person, you can trust them. You can let them go. You don't have to micromanage. You don't have to watch so closely. What's a way you discern integrity when you're in the interview process?
It's a great question. And it's actually one of our values. And when the way I define integrity is a couple of different ways. Obviously, there's the honesty component, right? If you're somebody that lies, that's table stakes. I can't have you at the company, like, period, right? But I find that a lot of integrity is also tied into reliability, say do, right? Somebody that when they say something, you know, you can count on it, you know, they can follow through. And that is a real value that we interview against here for the company. Here are a couple of things I do to try to identify integrity. The first thing is I map out our interview process and figure out all the people that are involved in the interview process. And I'll purposely stick variations of redundant questions throughout the process to find the consistency in their answers, right? And make sure that we're getting a similar story and it's tracking the same about why they might have left the job earlier than they should have, or adversity they overcame. So that's one way that we try to do it. I think there's simple cues you look at in terms of showing up on time, following through on getting a presentation that they were going to send to you, right? Or the references. That's a simple thing of both motivation and integrity. It goes back to what you were saying, you looked in the process. So I find that to be very, very important. I ask it of references, right? Can you give me examples of their integrity and ways that showed out in the times that you work with them? And this is going to be an interesting one. It might not sound like it's linked, but I think self-awareness is a really, really important trait of the people that I want to work in our company. And I find that people that tend to have a lot of self-awareness tend to have really good integrity, because if you're understanding about how you work and the mechanics of who you are,
how do you assess self-awareness?
Yeah. So, and how do you show how you appear in the world? And so this is the question I love to ask. I say, tell us a misconception about you and who the real you is. And I find that that answer gets them to open up about something. Now, number one, you find out a little bit about the victim side of their mentality, but you also get them to analyze, well, here's how people see me. They, you know, because I talk so fast, they think I'm salesy, but actually XYZ is the thing. Or, I've been told I'm an introvert, but really, if you get me around the right people, XYZ is the answer. What I find about that is that those people who answer that question well and can get into detail about it, a lot of times, number one, I will hear them say, like, yep, that would have been kind of my guess. And I'm glad that you brought that to bear. That's integrity to me, by the way, right? Yeah. If there's something that maybe I'm reading and you're reading and you bring it to bear in front of us, that means that you're okay being vulnerable and you're okay bringing truth to light, right? I also find that if you understand how you work, right, and you know if people can perceive you to be a certain way, it matters to you to show up in a way that people want to work with you, they want to be around you. So that's where that self-awareness question.
I love that question. That is a great question, man. That's, I don't ask.
Well, you gave me like five or six, man, so I had to repay you with at least one.
Freaking solid.
Awesome. Awesome. What about memorable interview experiences? I got to imagine you've seen some real, as somebody that is as in neuroscience deep as you are, you've seen some crazy situations, I'm sure, just people giving bad answers or people falling over themselves. But I'm interested in really good experiences too. So is there any experience that comes to mind when I ask you that?
Sure.
you don't have to name names.
No.
You can, but you don't have
to. I became Catholic like 5 years ago, and I kind of just went with it, you know? I was raised without much faith or spirituality. Meditation kind of led me down that path. My wife's Catholic, so I became Catholic. So I just kind of like, I'm going to buy in. I'm just going to go for it. And I went to this thing as Catholics. It's like this Father Joseph consecration thing. You're trying to learn how to be like Father Joseph. It's kind of a role model. And you do this thing. It's weird. You get a statue of Father Joseph and you put something under it that you want. And I wanted a co-founder for Dream Fuel, somebody who was that caliber. And I just put like, you know, whatever, I need a co-founder. I put it under the statue. You know, I'm thinking it's kind of superstitious, obviously, but just whatever. And then I, a woman was coming through the interview process for a client of ours, Greenlight Guru. And the hiring manager knows me really well. And I was like, this person's a freaking rock star. She's got a neuroscience degree from Notre Dame. Like, you need to talk to her. We want to hire her, but she's a, just, she's the right fit for you. So I talked to her. And as I'm sitting there, I see there's like a cross over her right shoulder. And I was like, oh, you know, you're Christian. That's cool. She's like, yeah. And she's like, I was like, oh, you know, I'm doing this thing, the Father Joseph thing. And she's like, oh, that's cool. She's like, my parents are doing that right now. And I was like, that's cool. And understanding she was a former pro athlete, a neuroscientist, loves this stuff. Like, it checked, she super high integrity, checked like every box I could ever want to check for a co-founder. You know, ambitious, motive, all the stuff we talked about mental performance wise. And then that little nod to the superstition of what I was doing was like, it was kind of a miraculous interview experience.
I mean, divine intervention, yeah, right? To get your co-founder.
That's, I was like, all right, you know, maybe this stuff has some validity to it, or just crazy random synchronicity, you know, coincidence, but
yeah. Whatever that is, it's serendipitous. It's amazing. And yeah. Listen, you got to take the sign when you get the sign like that. Did you go through like a longer process than that? Or was it kind of like, nope, let's be co-founders? Or did you, hey, let's get to know each other a little
more?
Yeah,
I mean, obviously, you know, we're not going to just like go on blind faith alone. But we, yeah, went and had coffee and, you know, dove into the behavioral stuff that I cared about and, you know, what she wanted to do with her life and everything. And all just checked out. Fantastic. She's on maternity right now, by the way, and I'm dying. She's like,
she's doing a lot of heavy lifting.
Well, no, she's on maternity. She just had her first kid. So like, I'm,
but she was doing a lot of heavy lifting.
She's our integrator. She was like doing like COO, like doing all the operation stuff. So I'm trying to balance both right now. I can't wait for her to get back.
She's are you EOS? Are you in EOS?
Yeah, I'm in EOS. Yeah. Yeah.
How's that going for you?
I really like it, man.
Yeah, we're in the process of getting ready to start it in the beginning of next year. So we're evaluating implementers and going through the whole process. Something you'd highly recommend?
Oh yeah, man. Wonderful. Yeah, it's just a great way to, and they have a good software, 90.io, I think it is, that just kind of helps with the keep it all organized. That's a great software platform. And yeah, we know the EOS guys a little bit, and also the chairman of EOS. He's a super great guy, David Mann, and just a great org.
Love it. This is awesome stuff. A lot of value, a lot of benefit for me. I hope so for our listeners too. Can't imagine it's not. So we talked a little bit when you miss on somebody. It sounds like you're hiring people that are kind of like you or have similar things like you. It sounds like you matured beyond that. Mm-hmm. What about candidate experience? Like, it's important that people know what it's like to work at Dream Fuel before they come work at Dream Fuel. Because as much as it's about you selecting somebody, it might even be more important for the individual to select to go to the right company, right? We've seen situations where people go through the interview process, think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, 2 weeks, and they're like, oh, this wasn't what I thought it was. Mm-hmm. What do you do to try to give people a sense of what it's like to work at Dream Fuel? How do you create a candidate experience that allows them to understand you, your co-founder, your team, and what you want out of potential people?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're as sophisticated as we could be at that. I think I've been more sophisticated in earlier incarnations, other businesses. We're still kind of that lean and mean team, you know? And I mean, frankly, my favorite, I have done this, I'm doing this right now, with a potential SDR candidate, just like temporary trial thing, you know, I'm like, let's just work together for a little while and see if we enjoy working together. And sometimes it takes a unique situation for them. Like, they might, you know, need to be like kind of in between jobs or something like that. But I always try my best to get the try before we both buy situation. That's my favorite.
It's the highest predicate of success. To your point, might limit your funnel. It's not always easy, you know, things like that. But if you can pull it off, that's one of the greatest indicators of somebody that's going to be a good fit or not. It's hard to. You can fake through an interview. It's hard to fake through, you know, 90 days of work.
No question. It becomes so obvious. And then there's those situations where you hire somebody and you're like, oh, for – it's like, how would you have caught it though? You know, I'm like, that's again where like, I know you're the expert.
Listen, this is what I do. It's an imperfect science. If I was sitting here telling you that I'm batting 1,000, that's a lie. That's not true. I've learned a lot. I've built different controls and processes in place, built technology that helps with it. My honest belief, and it's going to sound insane. I believe, and you're a sports fan too, so you'll get where I'm going with this. I think that when you draft an athlete to your team, it should be 100% that they're going to be the success that you pick them to be. I think the same thing when hiring an employee, and I think the same thing when investing in a company. The problem is that we don't know what's important to that success. We don't build the environment to that success, and we don't know how to qualify against that. If you had every understanding of the outputs or the inputs that lead to success, then you could draw out those outputs and know beforehand, at least with a higher level of confidence than we have now, that you're going to get a right fit. And I think one of the biggest market inefficiencies in this world right now is that we are really dealing off of gut and not enough science and not enough data and not enough understanding of what's even important, right, to be able to make those decisions. It's insane to me. You know, we're talking about Indianapolis Colts earlier, and you know, Anthony Richardson was drafted, right? We'll see if he ends up working out. But to me, like, this is, they dump billions of dollars into personnel and talent, and you get it wrong all the time. Invariably, there was, I think, four quarterbacks drafted in the first round of the NFL this year. The history tells us two of them are not going to be any good, right? And the other, another two will, or maybe pretty good and really good. Like, to me, that's not good enough. I wouldn't, if I owned a team, that wouldn't be my level. That wouldn't be my bar. And I try to set that bar here at my company too. And again, we don't always get it right. We are still learning.
I'll tell you, you know, on the mental performance side of that, you talked about setting the tracks best for them to be their best and kind of seeing them as their best. It's something similar to what I do in sales calls. I always, before I jump on a sales call, visualization is second to breath work to me. We did a big study on it with 200 tech leaders, and it was most correlated with tech leader performance, those who use visualization as a practice. And I would always visualize the case study. I still do before I jump on a big sales call. Like, it could be like a brand new prospect first call. I'm thinking about the case study when I go in, like, what's this case study going to look like? What are they going to say? You know, I'm dreaming about like the most amazing case study ever. And they jump on the call and my confidence is so high because in my subconscious mind, I'm like, this is a case study. Let's go, you know? And I think you think about with a new hire, what I advise the people that we coach is visualize the, whatever the case study is for that hire. Like, visualize the most success they could possibly have and visualize celebrating that with them. And before they come in day one, like, have that in your mind. Convince your subconscious that it's possible. And then at least you'll give them the best on-ramp possible, and they won't, you won't reinforce their imposter syndrome and stuff like that.
You're giving them the best chance to succeed, yeah. Which is really all it comes down to. There's some level of lack of control and variability that comes with people. It just is.
Yeah.
But if you've done a good job of identifying, you've been comprehensive, and then you create an environment where they have their best chance to be successful, nobody's doing that at an optimal level, in my opinion. So I think that changes over time. I think as we better understand neuroscience and requirements gathering and understanding ourselves, when you get all those together, right, in environmental circumstances, I think you can cut out a lot of the variability, if not all of it, in many, many, many cases.
100%.
I'm totally aligned with you on that. And the visualization thing is key too, because I told you when I meditate, I do this thing called the 6-phase meditation. Mm-hmm. And two of the phases are around envision the perfect day, because mm-hmm. I do it in the morning, right? What does the perfect day look like? And I start to think through my commute and my meetings and all of them, right? Mm-hmm. And then the next one is visualize 3 years out, mm-hmm. right? What does 3 years look at its optimal one? So I honestly struggle with that a little bit more on the professional side, just because it's like, I start thinking of things like we're on this magazine cover or we're on the ticker on CNBC or whatever it may be, right? And I love the case study. The case study idea is really good. I should be visualizing like that. Go ahead.
No, yeah. So what else do you struggle with as far as visualization goes? Because it is harder to do on your own.
Per individual, on a day coming up, I can think through what the right meeting looks like, what the outputs are, my drive home, my dinner with my wife, my kids, like all that stuff. And that's good because then it sets a baseline for your day. And then, you know what perfect looks like when you're stuck in traffic in the commute. Yeah. You're like, all right, well, you know, that's how it goes. I struggle with it more on the longer term for a few reasons. One is 3 years is what do they say? They say a year is shorter than you think, but 10 years, is, I don't know, 5 years to get something done is longer than
you think. You could do a hell of a lot more in 10 years than you can do in 6 months and whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have a hard time thinking about what does good look like in 3 years? Like, is it this or this or this? And then I also think about, am I visualizing the fruits of my success? Because that happens a lot, right? I have a great relationship with my wife and we're on a boat and we're traveling and doing the things we want to do. or is it visualizing the, you know, the contract being signed by a client?
Well, I can give you a little bit on this. So we do a lot of visualization, and visualization, we guide it. So think about just being narrated back to you, in a really, really productive way. And this is something most athletes do before going into the playoffs. They'll be guided by their mental performance coach, though. So they'll narrate the vision back to them. So the first thing you want to think about with visualization is you want to create as much neuroplasticity as humanly possible. So how do you create, because you want to create a memory of the future. You want this to be vivid. So how do you create neuroplasticity? Well, emotion. So the more emotional you get about the visualization, meaning the more dopamine, serotonin, endocannabinoids, whatever you drive, the more peptides you drive that create emotion, the more neuroplasticity you're going to create when you fall asleep that day. Neuroplasticity happens when we sleep. So yeah, the question is, like, what is the most emotional moment you could possibly get? And I would maybe, if you're talking about 3 years, step out of time a little bit. You know, normally when we do visualizations with the founder, it's the exit of their company. And it's not like we pick a time like 7 years from now or something. We just go, okay, this is when you ring the ticker at the NY, or when you ring the bell at the NYSE. And we will paint that scene as vividly as humanly possible. You know, the way to really get into a visualization is you got to use the five senses. So we call it 5-4-3-2-1. Five things you see, four things you hear, three things you feel, two things you taste, or two things you smell, one thing you taste. You don't have to follow that pattern. It's just a good way to kind of initiate it, to be thinking about what are you seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, hearing. Like, get the senses really wrapped into it. Again, we narrate this back. So you're just kind of in a meditative state and we're narrating it to you. And the most emotional high you're going to get that moment. Then the most rehearsal imagery or rehearsal visualization is what you really want to care about with visualization, which is, what are the behaviors you need to do to take your company public someday, particularly the things that are really hard for you, and what dragons or what obstacles do you have to overcome? So you take the heightened emotional state of ringing the bell at the NYSE and making the, you know, $100 million or whatever, and then you use that emotion to install all the behaviors that you need to do to win. And that's where, like, the real money's made in a visualization is, now you set yourself on autopilot to do the hard behaviors to overcome the really big obstacles and stuff. So, but yeah, you want to get into the most emotional state possible. So if it is a, you know, being on a boat with your family or something, celebrating, that's cool. Then make that vivid. You know, if it's, so you got to find that moment that's going to really resonate with you, and then use that as the basis, that scene, and then draw yourself back through all the things you did to get there.
All right, Kevin, that was amazing. I really appreciate, I've gotten more notes than I've ever taken in a podcast. I visualized the podcast before this. I didn't imagine it would come out this great. So I'm super appreciative.
Thanks, brother.
Of all the insights. Let's talk about a couple of things real quick before we wrap up. Anything you're working on right now that you're really, really excited about, that you're juiced about, get you out of bed in the morning?
I mean, that's why I build Dream Fuel. I love working with founders and CEOs who are creating innovative companies, especially the ones that kind of are making a positive impact on the world. And we get together 10 founders, 10 CEOs every quarter, and put them through our Octane program, which is kind of like our accelerator for high impact CEOs. And that's what I'm always juiced about.
That's your juice about working with great founders. I love that. Great answer. What about, is there a book you read maybe that really kind of started driving you towards more of the neuroscience space and breathing? Or is there just a book that you'd recommend for our listeners who have been really invested in this conversation and want to learn more?
I mean, I think Huberman's a great podcast to listen to, like, if you want to, like, really geek out on neuroscience. I'll take a little different of a perspective on books on our, like, we're going through right now as a society, we're starting the beginning of an event called the Singularity, coined by Ray Kurzweil.
I met Ray Kurzweil on Monday last week.
Crazy. Yeah. If you haven't read The Singularity Is Near and you're starting to get a little bit freaked out by what's happening right now, I think that's a great book just to calm you down and keep you centered as we go through what's going to be probably one of the most incredible next few decades that any human's ever lived through. And with AI, what's happening right now, like, I think it's just a great book because Kurzweil saw it coming and wrote a really good kind of guidebook about how to think about it. So I'd say that's my
recommendation. I was last Monday, I went to San Francisco for the Time Impact 100 in AI, right? And Ray Kurzweil was on there. And he was on the panel for the dinner. And I was taken by his, for somebody who's the godfather of artificial intelligence in a lot of ways, right? And somebody that's been studying it for a very, very long time. And quite frankly, said he predicted where we'd be right now, right? Yeah, and has a very strong concept of where we're going to be in another 10 to 15 years. And he's uniformly positive and talking about the abundance and talking about the capability and the possibility and so much you hear on kind of the downside. So I love that. And you should go check out my LinkedIn because I literally have a picture with me and him from the event.
That's some crazy coincidence right there.
Yeah. That's crazy. Father Joseph, back at it. Maybe I need to convert
to Catholicism. Jeez. I don't know.
All right, Kevin, last question. If you had one bit of advice that you wanted to give your 20-year-old self that you didn't know then but that you know now, what would you tell 20-year-old Kevin?
You're going to go through a lot of things, some good, some bad. Know that it will 100% all be worth it.
I love that. Any notes? Anything you'd add to that or just that?
Yeah, I think sometimes, or especially earlier, you know, I would flirt with the victim mentality a little bit. Obviously, at this point, you know, I'm very aware of it. But when I was younger, you know, I didn't quite understand that it would be worth it. And I look back, in hindsight, it's obviously 2020, and it's like every little piece of it is perfectly in the puzzle the way it needed to be. But I didn't think I understood that when I was younger in my 20s.
Yeah, my theory on that is that as humans, we're incredibly industrious and resilient. And so even when bad things happen, we end up finding our way within that bad thing. And I think in most cases, making the most of it, not letting us tear us down. That's ultimately the difference between people who are successful or not, right? It's why you'll see one person go through some really like hard circumstances growing up and maybe have a brother or sister going through the exact same thing or a neighbor. And this person ends up in jail or in a bad situation. And this person ends up being CEO of a company. And really, life is not about our experiences. It's about our reactions to our experiences. And so one of the things, and it might be rationalization, bad things happen, it's going to happen. But we end up tend to making it work for us in the best way possible. And that's why when you get to the end of your story, end of your journey, you're usually looking back and saying, it ended up working out for the best. Even when something I thought at the time that happened that was devastating or was going to take me to my knees, I learned to live with it. And it made me better for X, Y, Z reason.
I love it. I mean, that's in the name of our company, Dream Fuel. Like, I came to me in a deep meditation. I thought of my friends who kept pursuing their dreams and that it dropped off and how much happier the ones who were still on the dream were. And it made me realize that the dream, and we help people go after their dreams, isn't even the thing that matters that much. It's like who you become when you're chasing it. Like, that's the point of the dream, I think, is like, you're going to change tremendously and become a much better, more fulfilled, happier person as you keep pursuing that dream, as long as you got the tools, the fuel.
I absolutely love it. Did we just become best friends? This is an incredible podcast, brother. I appreciate you. I'm definitely going to get out to Indianapolis and get that cocktail sauce.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm down, man.
Thank you for coming on, brother. Namaste. Have a good day.
Appreciate it. Take it easy, brother.
All right. Talk to you later.